you remember Rise Up Singing? That iconic songbook that had friends and families lifting up their voices together.
We wanted to have a way that people who were singing with us would be able to fully participate in the singing by having the lyrics in their hands. And we just discovered there was really no book around, no songbook around that had the range of songs that people wanted and needed to sing together in front of them. And so since we couldn't find a book like that, we decided we needed to make one.
As simple as that.
That's Peter Blood and Annie Patterson, co-creators of Rise Up Singing, and now the sequel, Rise Again. We talk with them about both songbooks, their work with Pete Seeger, and their long collaboration as a musical couple. Then we air part of an interview I did with journalist and anti-fracking activist Maura Stevens. The full interview is posted at our website. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Back when I was a teenager, we used to have what we then called hootenannies, get-togethers to sing folk songs. At parties and picnics, there was always at least one kid who could strum a guitar, and the rest of us carried the tune. Group singing has always had a powerful energy for me, and after college I even joined a chorus for a time, run by the late, great Barbara Dane. Then I grew up and became a mother, and my group singing days seemed over. But in 1988, the wonderful songbook Rise Up Singing came out, and mothers and fathers throughout the land, along with lots of other people, rejoiced. Now we could share the songs of yesteryear and current times with our kids. With 1,200 songs, Rise Up Singing covered a lot of bases. But it was hard to use if you didn't know the tune, because all it had were the lyrics and the chord changes. On the other hand, that did mean you had to get together with others who did know the tune, which added to the fun. Now Peter Blood and Annie Patterson, the creators of Rise Up Singing, have come out with another all-new songbook, Rise Again. And this time it's linked to a website and a YouTube channel that will have you remembering old songs and learning new ones in no time. Rise Again has divided its songs into genres like ballads and old songs, blues, British invasion and rock, country, dignity and diversity, earth care, freedom, and all the way on down to work. Annie Patterson and Peter Blood are musicians, song leaders, and songbook makers. They lead sing-along concerts and workshops at festivals, schools, and private events. Peter Blood was active in the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Annie Patterson is a singer-songwriter and jazz vocalist with several CDs of her own work. Both had a long association with Pete Seeger, and they helped him put out his musical memoir, Where Have All the Flowers Gone? Peter Blood and Annie Patterson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Hi.
This book, Rise Again Songbook, I have to say I was so happy when I heard that you had put out a sequel, a follow-up to Rise Up Singing, which is a book that I got in 1992. It came out first in 1988, really was just a wonderful part of my son growing up. We used to sing songs together. I used to bring it to dinners where I had friends. Talk a bit about what moved you to do the original book.
Basically, we've been song leaders for many, many years, and we wanted to have a way that people who were singing with us would be able to fully participate in the singing by having the lyrics in their hands. And we just discovered there was really no book around, no songbook around that had the range of songs that people wanted and needed to sing together in front of them. And so since we couldn't find a book like that, we decided we needed to make one.
As simple as that.
So describe that original book and what it took to bring that about.
Well, the original book, Rise Up Singing, was a collection of 1,200 songs. People who might not, in the audience that might not know it, it's guitar chords and lyrics. And I would say this book has just a really wide variety of genres from Broadway musicals to Motown to lullabies to your traditional folk songs that, you know, maybe you learned in school. But it also has a bunch of songs in it at the time it came out in 1988 that were fairly contemporary songs written by contemporary songwriters that had messages for the world that we felt the world really needed to hear.
Pete Seeger was our mentor in our music work, as he was for many other people, and he loved this book. He talked about it a lot at his concerts. He talked a lot about it when he met with people individually, and what he loved about it was the diversity of song material in it. He said, how can you find a book that has gospel and songs for children, play party songs, and Beatles and Broadway songs and Motown all in one book? He absolutely loved the fact that people who enjoyed different kind of songs could come together and sing with each other.
So now we have Rise Again. Tell us, why did you want to update it?
Oh my gosh. Well, okay. In 1988, when we made Rise of Singing, we had no idea how popular the book would be. I mean, even though we had wonderful folks like Pete Seeger helping us and mentoring us, and I guess the book just took off little by little, song circles around the country and then around the world. And before we knew it, we had almost a million copies sold. And around, I guess it was around 1998, Peter and I looked at each other. We said, we got to make another book. I mean, all these great songs were being written between when we first came out with Rise Up Singing. And also, I have to say, you know, we have a world that is constantly changing. There's constantly challenges and political challenges and social justice challenges. And we both feel that singing together helps us get through those kinds of times.
Now, this book has another 1,200 songs, and they're completely new. Is that right?
No overlap.
Yep, there's no overlap at all. So really, if you have Rise Up Singing and then you have Rise Again, you've got a lot of songs.
People ask us, how could you come up with 1,200 more songs? And we actually probably listened to 5,000 or 6,000 songs to choose the 1,200. There were many, many wonderful, wonderful songs that we didn't include.
And where did you find these songs?
You know, we have had over the years a lot of contact with a variety of musicians, a variety of people who just, you know, regular folks who just love to sing. And we've stayed in touch with some of these folks around the country and now around the world. There's Rise Up Singing song circles in China and all over the place. So we contacted a bunch of these folks to let them know that we were working on this new book. But we also had a list that we had put together back in 1998 with some very prominent songwriters and song leaders. And that list was something that we kind of took and looked at again about, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. And we said, okay, since 1998, more songs have been written. So let's figure out how do we prune it down. And believe me, it was really tough because there's a lot of great songs out there.
Even though Rise Up Singing was a very diverse book, it was heavily weighted towards what you might call folk singer-songwriter material, and we definitely wanted to expand the bar, so to speak, within the new book. And so we actually went to people who were what you might call experts in certain song genres, and we had somebody from a klezmer band recommending Yiddish songs. We had a number of rabbis and cantors recommending great Hebrew songs or Jewish songs. And
we had people in the hospice movement, like Kate Munger was very involved in
threshold choirs.
I mean, we just sort of went to the people we knew of who we felt were experts in a particular field. And a lot of how we chose the songs at the end of the day was after looking at them and really listening to them, just trying to figure out, A, is it a song that people can sing together? Does it have a chorus that really gets people moving? And then B, does the song have a message that we really need to hear? Because believe me, there's so much going on out there that we feel songs are vital to helping get people the information they need and to help them feel hopeful.
So now, yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because just last weekend I was in New York City and I was coming down Houston Street just toward Broadway, two big streets, and began to hear the unmistakable sounds of a march. It turned out to be a march for Bernie Sanders. It was about 2,000 people. It was just amazing, totally joyous. But it really struck me that we had no songs. We had chants, and you had chants that would start up, and then people would get tired of them, and they'd die down, and somebody else would do another chant. But I thought, dang, we really need a song for the political revolution.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is, I mean, you know, Pete Seeger really believed in getting people to sing for all kinds of reasons. And he would say, it doesn't have to be a song that has a political message, but you can still be singing it together in order to kind of keep hope alive and remind people that, you know, that we have heart, we have reasons for really wanting to be together and work things out. And I mean, there's some good songs out there for political marches. It's just, you know, how do you find them? How come people aren't singing them?
Yeah.
Can I say something about that? Basically, many, many social movements in the past, music was really central to them. So, for example, slaves escaping on the Underground Railroad sang coded songs to help them to keep their hope alive and help them prepare for escape. The union movement, the labor movement, had many, many songs starting in the late 19th century that were repurposed from gospel songs or from other songs to be used for the labor struggles. The same was true of the civil rights movement, for the peace movement. And we've often done programs at schools talking about the thread of use of songs by different movements to keep the movement united and drawn together. It is absolutely true that in the current day, we're still a little bit thin on songs for the climate movement and for movements like what's going on now with Bernie Sanders. And we've certainly, with both Rise Up Singing and Rise Again, had whole chapters of songs on economic issues, on labor struggles, on freedom struggles. And we know how important those songs are to people's ability to make changes.
Yeah, and you yourself got introduced to this. I was reading about your history, Peter Blood, going down to the South to be part of the civil rights movement. What was your experience, and how did it inspire you in the work that you do here?
When I was doing voter registration work in Mississippi while I was going to college, every evening we would go to a community center in the neighborhood. We lived in an African-American community while we were doing this work. And we would sing for an hour or more every evening songs of the civil rights movement. And it was clear that those songs made a huge difference for that community to not feel overwhelmed by the challenges they met. I also lived and worked in the Poor People's Campaign in Washington, D.C. after Martin Luther King was killed in 1968. And again, whole churches full of people. Often 1,000 or more people would be gathered coming out of Resurrection City to keep their sense of vision and purpose alive, used music continually to inform what they were doing and to undergird it.
And Annie, you are a singer and a performer. Could you talk a little bit about the difference in the experience between performing as a performer up on stage and the sing-alongs and the singing together that you've been so involved with?
Sure. You know, I've been performing for a long time. I am a jazz vocalist. I sing with a band called Girls from Mars. And I also perform as a folk performer, too. You know, there's a real difference with song leading. Song leading is getting up on stage and always thinking, how can I encourage the room full of people to feel, you know, safe enough and kind of relaxed enough to really let their hair down and enjoy singing with each other? And when we lead singing, you know, a lot of the goal for us is that during the intermission, people will turn and introduce themselves to each other and kind of go, wow, you know, I'm here. I want to do this more. This is really kind of a community feeling. Whereas performing is more about training my voice, working on my vocal, my vocal warm-ups, and having been a vocal coach, you know, a lot of focus for me is on my voice, because that's where I tend to feel that that's the gift I want to give. So when I'm performing, it's more like I'm on stage, I'm going to give people the gift of music. They're going to listen to it and enjoy it and really hear the intonation and all of that. Whereas song leading is more, you know, let's get people singing harmony together. And it's just, it's a different kind of feel.
The boundary line isn't quite as sharp, though, as you might think, because, for example, Pete Seeger's concerts over the years constantly were based on getting the audience to sing with him, teaching songs, leading songs. You had often thousands of people in countries where they didn't even speak English singing along with Pete to songs that they may not have even known before they came to the concert. Many singers, for instance, African-American jazz singers, got their first singing experience in the black churches, where they were doing group singing with the audience, and they had to kind of translate that personal singing with a community into later performing.
I mean, I want to say, too, that sometimes as a performer, you can get really isolated. You perform on your own. Maybe you do the same few sets all the time, and you know, you're kind of crafting this show. And what we found this fall when we did a Rise Again tour with several other musicians is the musicians would say, you know, gosh, it just feels so good to be singing with other people. And that's, I think, the idea behind a lot of what we do when we do sing-along concerts. It's more of a community feeling, even with the people that are on stage. Everybody's part of the community.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Peter Blood and Annie Patterson about their issue of a sequel to Rise Up Singing. It's called Rise Again. It's a group singing songbook. Now, you spoke about Pete Seeger, and he wrote the preface to this new book, Rise Again, before he died. I was really struck by one of the things he says in it. He says, "The older I get, the more I'm convinced that if there's a human race here," that I think he means in like 100 years, "singing will be one of the main reasons why. Singing together, not solo singing, singing together." And I was really struck with that. So now you, Peter, you worked closely with Pete Seeger. Talk about, you know, how that work was. You actually even worked on his biography, his a kind of biography songbook.
We started working with Pete on Rise Up Singing. He persuaded Sing Out magazine to publish Rise Up Singing because he was on the board at the time with Toshi. And his manager helped us to get permissions for many, many of the songs that we probably couldn't have gotten permissions for otherwise in Rise Up Singing. And he played a big role in shaping the song list also for Rise Up Singing. And his experience of working with us, and particularly closely with me, on Rise Up Singing led him to ask his manager to kind of twist my arm to be the editor of his autobiography. Harold Leventhal had run into some problems with a lot of songs slipping out of copyright status because of the way Pete had handled them rather casually over time, and they kind of had become public domain songs without his intending it. So Harold's goal was to keep material connected to Pete Seeger and connected to a copyright status. But Pete's goal all along was much more to tell the story of his life. And so that's how this book, which is called Where Have All the Flowers Gone, a sing-along memoir, kind of evolved into a kind of a dual-purpose role of being a songbook and an autobiography. And basically what he did with the book was he wrote in great detail about what was happening in his life when each of these songs was written, who worked with him, what kind of person that he was using as a collaborator, and things that were going on in his life, work with the environmental movement, work with the civil rights movement, work, of course, with the anti-Vietnam War movement. And again, the way those movements were infused with music, and the roles these and other songs played in them.
Yeah, it's a really striking book, and it also comes with a data CD where you can actually download the songs that are in Where Have All the Flowers Gone. Before we leave Pete Seeger, I wanted to ask you, what struck you most about him as a person and as a performer?
Well, you know, getting to know Pete like we did with him coming down to the house and working on this book with Peter, and also throughout many of the years that we were working on Rise Again, Pete was pretty involved, you know, calling us up, wanting to talk to us and suggest songs and writing us postcards. And, you know, we come to find out that this is what he did for everybody that he really believed in, especially folks that, you know, he just really wanted to encourage the work they did. He had so much energy for really supporting other people. And yet he was so humble. And what you saw on stage was really kind of who he was. He was a very giving person and very talkative and somebody who, you know, you kind of wanted to drop everything and listen to his stories. There were just so many of them.
Pete had a vision of the world, which I guess could be kind of summed up, all that sounds not as profound as how he described it, as multiculturalism. He believed that the way in which conflicts and tensions within the world could be overcome would be people learning from each other and getting to experience different ways of looking at the world, experiencing culture. That's how he saw songs evolving, was different threads coming together in a new creation. But he also saw that happening in political movements and in communities all across the world. He traveled extensively, so he got to see this happening all over the world. And I believe that his ability to create a vision of how people could get along with each other and could create change had enormous impacts that we're only beginning to see the effects of.
You know, you can't talk about Pete without talking about Toshi, because Pete's wife, Toshi, was part of why he could travel so much, but also just an incredible organizer herself. She kind of kept Pete together. And towards the later years of their marriage, and, you know, Pete would really just constantly shine a light on her and say, you know, look, I wasn't there to help raise my kids. And also, she was just intimately involved in the causes that he believed in as well.
You could do a whole program, Francesca, on how couples work together on projects. It's a pretty unique role. It's certainly been important in our lives and many of the couples that are performing couples that we know. It's really hard to be intimately related as a couple to each other and also try and be creative together in creating a book or in creating other kinds of projects.
We'll say just a little bit more about that. What have you... I mean, I get the sense that this has probably strengthened your relationship. So talk about the challenges and how that has, you know, perhaps strengthened the bond that you have.
Well, you know, there's so many people who are in a couple relationship who work together all over. And, you know, when you meet them, you kind of, and you're that way as well, you sort of find out these things you have in common. I mean, you know, Peter and I have been married for over 31 years now. We found in each other, when we first met each other, a real love of music and a real a deep, deep love of the human race and wanting to kind of commit ourselves to finding ways to be healthy humans. And, I mean, that sort of seems a little bit simple, but I think we both had this desire to help other people figure out how to enjoy singing together. And that's really been at the core of what's held us together through tough times.
I don't think it's easy to work together as a couple at all. And I think many more marriages have been destroyed by trying to work together than been strengthened by it.
Yeah.
And it certainly has been very, very challenging for us too. Sexism makes it very hard for heterosexual couples to work side by side. we find that people frequently assume that work has been done by me, that's actually been done by both of us, and that's very challenging. In spite of myself, I often tend to not treat Annie with the full collaborative respect that she deserves. So I think that you have to really, really work hard, and you have to really make sure that your values are clear and that your sense of love is clear to be able to work out the hurdles of working side by side. And I would say, actually, that even though we shared a lot of the same values, spiritually and music-wise and social change-wise, even though those things were in common, it was very, very difficult to work together on these projects. But in the end of the day, we've made it work, and we've created some important things.
You know, I think the biggest thing that I would say to anybody is, you know, you just can't sweat some of the small stuff too much, and you can't worry about whether your project is perfect, because these books aren't perfect. There's a ton of things people can find in them that are, you know, little typos or things we didn't get quite right. And, you know, if we were really hard on each other, it's because we're really hard on ourselves. But at some point, we've had to stop and go, okay, I got to let that one go. Okay, I got to let that next one go. And I guess that really applies to relationships, too.
Fortunately, I have a very loving and forgiving wife.
Oh, please. We're both stubborn. Are you kidding me?
I was thinking when Peter said that, you know, he was kind of saying that sometimes he hasn't behaved quite the way he wanted to, I was thinking to myself that I'm sure you put him back on the right track, Annie.
Yeah, people kind of know that about me. And in some ways, sometimes I maybe my own little things I have to work on is really appreciating Peter when he is being, you know, great about shining a light on the things that need to be cleared up. I mean, you know, he's right about the sexism part. There's an awful lot out there where if you're in a business relationship and you're working with a man, you're female, a lot of times people do tend to look to the man as if he's in charge. And I don't even want to go into it. There's so many times that that's happened with us.
Oh, I'm sure. But here's a good time, actually, to shine a light on you, because you are the performer in this duo. And I'd like to ask you if you would sing us a song of your choice.
Sure. Be happy to. Be happy to. All right. Let me grab my guitar. Yeah, so we're going to do a song called Hallelujah. This is a song by a Canadian songwriter named Catherine Wheatley. And we actually put a lot of songs by Canadian songwriters in Rise Again and got a lot of help on that from our buddy Jack Cole up in Canada. And we just think this is a great song. We've been singing it at a lot of our concerts.
He'll be whistling while he works. He'll be whistling while he works. Whistling, he'll be whistling, whistling while he works.
Hello?
Yep, too loud?
I think you're pegging out. Are you going to really watch those levels? Because I can hear distortion.
So I can pull this back a little bit, too.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think you'll have to pull it back from your mouth. Yeah. Okay.
Let's try again.
Okay.
He'll be whistling while he works. He'll be whistling while he works. He'll be whistling, whistling while he works. She'll be tending their garden green. She'll be tending their garden green. She'll be tending, she'll be tending, tending their garden green. She'll be holding, she'll be holding.
Annie Patterson, accompanied by Peter Blood in the song Hallelujah. We'll talk more about their new songbook, Rise Again, after the break.
Well, may the world go, the world go, the world go. Well, may the world go when I'm far away. Swimmers turn, the lovers burn. Peace may the generals learn when I'm far away. Well, may the world go, the world go, the world go. Well, may the world go when I'm far away. Sweet may the fiddle sound.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with song leaders Annie Patterson and Peter Blood, creators of the best-selling songbook Rise Up Singing, about the sequel to that iconic book. It's called Rise Again and features 1,200 new songs. In other words, none of the songs that appeared in Rise Up Singing appear in Rise Again. So now, back to this wonderful songbook that you have come out with, Rise Again, the follow-up to Rise Up Singing, which came out first in 1988, and you've been working on this for, wow, over 15 years. One of the issues with the first Rise Up Singing is that if I didn't know the melody of a song, I couldn't play it. I couldn't like learn new songs, but now there is the magic of YouTube, and you've teamed up with it with this amazing website and a YouTube channel. So talk about this whole web aspect to this book and how people can now learn these songs.
Well, we really wanted with this new book to utilize all the things that you can get on the web. And we decided pretty early on that we wanted to have our website be a bit of a hub where people could go and find all kinds of information out. In Rise Up Singing, I produced a bunch of teaching tapes. So you can learn every song in that book. But you have to be able to, get the CD or at least look under the liner notes and find out where you can learn it. And same with Rise Again. We made sure underneath each song are all the different ways that you can find it, different kinds of resources.
The best way to learn the songs is actually either to go to the performers' concerts or buy their CDs,
yeah,
or to have sing-alongs with your friends and basically learn the song one-to-one from each other. But if the people in your local singing group or your family don't know the song, you can't learn it that way. YouTube is a terrific way. Every one of the 1,200 songs in Rise Again, either was already on YouTube or we've actually created new YouTube videos for. So if you plug in the name of the song, you can either go to our website and get a link to the song, or else you can just go directly to YouTube and put in the name of the song and the person who performed it and learn the song.
Well, we have playlists that are on YouTube too. I mean, we have Rise Again playlists that we're creating, and a lot of people that are familiar with YouTube know that you can go to a playlist and it has one song after another. And what we've done is we've created playlists of all the songs in a given chapter. And you can look up that chapter name, you can look up Rise Up and Sing, or you can look up Rise Again Songbook, and you'll find a lot of the songs that are there. And eventually we'll have all of them, and you can clearly get that from our website, riseupandsing.org.
We're huge fans of YouTube, and we do not have any stock in the company. basically, what this enables people to do, if they hear about a wonderful new song that they've never heard before, they can email somebody on the other side of the earth, and just a few minutes later, the other person can be listening to the same song that they're listening to and learning it and being ready to play it. So this makes our books, Rise Up Singing and Rise Again, even more useful for people to be able to sing with each other and to share songs with each other, because they can use YouTube to learn the songs and they can use the book to make sure that they know the guitar chords and the lyrics.
Wow, that's terrific. I just have one last question for the two of you, and that is, I know you're both Quakers, and I'd like to know would you like to say something about how your faith as Quakers has informed your work?
Well, both of us are Quaker. Peter was raised in a Quaker family. I came to it a little later on. And I would say it's really informed our work. It's informed how we work. You know, Quakers are pacifists, and we really believe in, I guess what you might say, that there is that of God in every person. You might call it the light, or, you know, a lot of people refer to it in different ways. But for us, it's just this belief that there is an inner light that we can turn to that is a higher power. And we certainly turn to it a lot in times of stress. And believe me, making a songbook of this that's this extensive is very stressful. But I would say also, being Quaker, you know, we just really believe in social justice, and it's a big piece of Quakerism and the history of early Quakers on. And that definitely has shaped the kinds of songs we would choose in putting in a songbook like this.
Obviously, there's a very, very intimate relationship between spirituality and music in general, and lots of music has been informed by spirituality, whether it's gospel or spirituals or more traditional classical choral music. But it's clear to us that there's the power to change people's lives within them, in their own hearts. And music can touch people very, very deeply. Many times at our sing-along concerts, the whole concert just falls into a sense of hush because everyone present has been deeply touched in their heart by the song that we just sang together. And in the end of the day, even though we listen to many, many thousands of songs to choose songs, in the end of the day, we kind of had to listen to our own heart, to which songs struck a deep chord and we felt this song needs to be in the book. In the end of the day, it wasn't really a rational decision. It wasn't exactly any kind of a sense of parameters as to, or criteria as to what did or didn't go in. It was whether our hearts said this song needs to be in there because of the way it affected us and because the way we believed it would affect other people's hearts as well and lives.
I mean, I will say, even though we're Quaker, we had so many wonderful folks help us make both these songbooks that come from a wide variety of backgrounds, from atheists to, you know, all different kinds of religions. And I would say if there's any one thing that that we both believe is that people need to find their own way, and we certainly are not of a branch of Quakerism that tries to proselytize it. But really, you know, Peter's right about the heart piece. And I think anybody, no matter what you believe, if you can kind of start to pay attention to what your heart's telling you, it'll lead you in a good direction.
You know, many people ask us how we could have possibly done such a gigantic project. And it was a gigantic project. Both books took us 3 or 4 years of full-time work to create. But, you know, we're tremendous fans of a book called The Artist's Way. I'm sure you're familiar with it. And in The Artist's Way, the author says that basically, I think she uses the word God, that God basically touches the hearts and the lives of artists and allows a creative process to spill forth if the artist gets things out of the way that could be impediments of that. And we frequently turned to the ideas that were developed in The Artist's Way to help us make us through this huge project by basically grounding ourselves and making sure that things got out of the way that could have gotten in the ability of the Spirit to enable us to be tools in terms of this creative process.
Well, I'm so glad that you guys came out with this book and so glad that you could talk with us about it. The book is Rise Again, a group singing songbook, and we've been talking with its creators and editors, Peter Blood and Annie Patterson. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
Annie Patterson and Peter Blood's Rise Again is the sequel to Rise Up Singing. Go to writersvoice.net to hear them sing and for links to the book and its YouTube channel. issue of fracking has come up frequently this primary election season, at least on the Democratic side, with sharp differences between the two contenders. Next week, I'll be talking with novelist Jennifer Haig, whose just-released book, Heat and Light, is about what happens when fracking comes to a small Pennsylvania community. We'll also talk with journalist Andrew Nikiforuk about the remarkable story of a geologist-turned-fracking opponent. His book is Slick Water. A few weeks ago, I spoke with New York anti-fracking activist and journalist Maura Stevens. She's a founding member of the Coalition to Protect New York and Frackbusters New York. I posted the interview on the Writer's Voice website. Here's an edited version of that interview. Well, Maura Stevens, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much, Francesca.
I went to your website for the Coalition to Protect New York, and I started reading an incredible story there, which is a story about Megan Holleran's family and eminent domain. Could you tell us what's going on with this family and how the law is being applied by the pipeline to destroy their livelihood?
Well, the Holleran family is just one of scores, perhaps hundreds of families that are going through this right now, but it's a wonderful family and a heartbreaking story. Megan and her family run they have a really beautiful piece of property in Montrose, Pennsylvania, just south of Binghamton, New York. And it's just a pristine, gorgeous piece of property. It's a hillside and a beautiful maple stand, and they've been tapping maple trees to boil the sap to make syrup for many, many years. And the Constitution pipeline there are so many pipelines threatening so many communities, it's a little hard to keep track of them all, but the Constitution pipeline was going from Pennsylvania through several counties in New York State up through near Binghamton. And the pipeline was permitted, as almost all of them are, by FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is responsible for interstate pipelines permitting. And it had been permitted in Pennsylvania, but not yet in New York. So the families, many families had sold out or accepted this paltry sum of money for the pipeline to go through their property. But the Hollerans and many other people were adamantly opposed to it. The Hollerans fought as much as they could. They did all the legal appeals and all the filed all the paperwork and all the things saying that this would be irreparable harm to their business. They wanted to cut through the maple stand right at maple syruping time, so they would have lost their entire income for this year as well as all future years from that operation. And they held out. Hundreds of people came to stand with them in the cold and the snow for weeks on end. I was among them, and it was a beautiful outpouring of support and fellowship, but it failed. And the courts ordered that the devastation of the trees could begin, even though there was no permit for the actual pipeline to continue into New York State. Many miles of trees have been cut down, thousands and thousands of carbon-capturing trees, life-giving trees, syrup-giving trees, habitat for other creatures have been cut down for this pipeline that may or may not ever be put in. And it was done, the last order was given to make it happen. They told the peaceful resistors that they would be jailed if they resisted any further. They sent out SWAT teams with all sorts of weapons to make sure that nobody got in the way of the chainsaws. It was absolutely devastating for the family and all those who were trying to protect the natural environment. And also,
aside from the ecological damage and the damage to the livelihood of the Halloran family, they were not even offered any compensation. Is that correct?
No. The eminent domain, which is a legal construct in which a government is able to seize someone's property, must compensate them. There's no real specific. It says fairly compensate them for the what is taken, but it's supposed to be used for a public good, such as a hospital or a highway or railway or something that's going to bring good to the public in the community in which it's passing through. In this case, the gas that's going to be passing through, volatile gas, very close to homes, which does leak. People say it potentially leaks. Well, that's because scientists are so careful not to say it will, because nobody can predict what will happen. But heavens, it will, because it always does and it always has, and there's no way to make it not leak. And it's volatile, and it's very likely that some of these will explode at some point along the way, because there's so many compressor stations and so many other places where leakages and accidents can occur. And we're seeing that companies are being less and less, or more and more lax and less careful about safety as their profits become more important. But this gas is all intended, it's going outside Pennsylvania. These communities are getting nothing in compensation for it. But they do get some small, what I would say, kind of chump change, because their whole history of their family, which has been there for many years, is being wiped out. So you can't really compensate for that.
Now, we've been talking about Pennsylvania, but you are in New York, and you're fighting this on part of the Coalition for New York. What's New York's interest in this?
Well, I believe that the people in this movement really feel like we're all in this together, because it is all one pipeline. And we know our neighbors to the south. They've been coming up here to try and help us alert our communities to what's happening to them and to keep us from suffering the same tragedies that they're suffering, health tragedies, loss of their homes, loss of their livelihoods, loss of their way of life and their dreams, really. We know so many people who've come up here and given their time and effort to come and help us avoid that, and we feel very responsible to them. And we really are all in this together. You know, the climate isn't going to pick the rich people on Long Island to protect, you know, or the rich people in some other community to protect. We're all becoming equalized in this time of radical climate revolution.
I'm Francesca Rhiannon, host of Writer's Voice. I'm speaking with Maura Stevens of Frackbusters New York about the fracking issue and its impact on both Pennsylvania and New York. Your group is working on issues. The other organization that you work with, Frackbusters New York, makes some, I think, pretty important points. One thing, when I went to the website to look at it, I was surprised to see that the so-called ban on fracking is not really a ban on fracking, and nor is it even a moratorium on all fracking. So explain to us, what's going on in New York? What about this so-called ban?
Well, I think that many anti-fracking activists rightly celebrated when the governor agreed with the medical assessment that fracking should not be done per se right away. But we're talking, we should have mentioned up front that the way we identify fracking, the way we define it, is not just the fracking itself, where millions of gallons of pure fresh water are toxified with numerous chemicals, including endocrine disruptors and neurotoxins and carcinogens, and then blasted down into shale or sand to extract little tiny bubbles of methane. But because that is what the industry defines fracking as, we define it as further. It's everything from the exploitation when they do seismic testing in an area to find out if they can find enough gas to make it worth their while to come in and do the actual fracking, all the way to your kitchen stove. And then all the other things that are fractured along the way, such as our health, our air, our water supplies, our food supply, and indeed our legislatures and our judicial system, because those are enabling these devastating industrial activities to come through our communities. So it's a whole fracture, you know, includes the media, which are also involved, except for independent media like you and the ones that I work for as a journalist. Most of them are just towing the line of the corporation. But the horizontal, high-volume horizontal hydrofracking, which is this very new technology, was developed in the 90s and only started to be used in our area in this century. That fracking has been banned. It really hasn't been banned. There's a sort of a temporary extension of the moratorium, because the minute the legislature decides that they want to overrule the governor or a new governor is elected, you know, that could change. So any kind of ban like that that is, you know, celebrated as a ban, people need to be careful, because as this so-called fracking ban is imposed, we're having thousands of miles of pipelines going crisscrossing New York State. And, you know, they've been trying to put the Port Ambrose, fortunately, that right off the coast of Long Island, Port Ambrose export terminal was defeated for now, thanks to the good work of the great people in New York City and Long Island who are actively working against that kind of thing. But meanwhile, we have toxic waste dumping in New York State landfills, and it's radioactive frack waste from Pennsylvania. The one just 15 miles from my home in Chemung County, New York, they're trying to expand it, double the size of it, to take more radioactive frack waste from Pennsylvania and other places. And although the people have been going to the legislature month after month after month, 98% of them saying, do not want this expansion. In fact, we want to take this dump down altogether and get rid of it. The legislature is completely deaf to their pleas, and it just goes along with whatever the corporations want. So we're seeing this fracturing of our legislatures up close and personal in our own towns and counties.
The Frackbusters New York website also says that the moratorium that Governor Cuomo has imposed could be reversed.
Right. It could be reversed. All these protections are very fragile. Our systems are so fluid and so subject to whim and political pressure. And indeed, you know, just imagine if the Trans-Pacific Partnership goes through. This is one of the things that terrifies us the most. This transnational agreement would enable a foreign corporation to essentially say, this community is banning something that we want to do, and that is not acceptable, so we have the power to come in and tell that community that tough luck, you have to take it, whatever it is that we're going to do. We're going to dump toxic waste near your school, or, you know, there are the provisions in the TPP and the secrecy with which it's all been negotiated and will continue to be run. If that Trans-Pacific Partnership goes through, we, you know, even in our own communities, it's not simply a global issue. It's a really local issue that people should get up to speed on. It's a complicated issue, but the simple fact is we are vulnerable to corporate control from corporations, even outside, that are based outside our country and have no U.S. laws and local laws have no bearing on these companies. They've become very powerful.
So it's this attack on national, state, and local sovereignty.
Exactly.
Now, another thing is that now I understand that the moratorium does not apply to all fracking.
Right. There is still low-volume horizontal fracking going on, so companies can... I actually don't want to be quoted on the number, because I think the number has changed of how many gallons can be considered high volume. But, of course, that's another thing that's fluid. So the law, the rules change as the corporations need different things and buy different legislators to enable their insidious shenanigans. But, yes, and then vertical drilling is still permitted. So there is still some drilling going on in the state. What's particularly interesting is that New York State is not a mining state. You know, other states have surface ownership by the homeowner, and everything under their home and land is owned by the state. So the state can sell it off to whatever mineral company they want, like Texas and Oklahoma, even Pennsylvania, where coal mining has been going on forever. But New York State is not accustomed to this, and we don't. This is a total assault on everything. We're just not, you know, Western states, it's not so uncommon to have that kind of split estate, as it's called. But here, we've never had that. And having seen what it does elsewhere, we don't want it. And it's not just a NIMBY thing, because we recognize that the air and water aren't subject to political boundaries. And the climate is affecting us all. And we all, in the places that still have clean, fresh water, which are the places to which other people are going to be migrating, we desperately have to protect the water there. So all of New York State is blessed with beautiful fresh water. And for us to even consider fracking it is simply insane. And now with pipelines going in around the nuclear power plant at Indian Point, which is ancient and crumbling and has been leaking and having some fires lately, scary, and then one pipeline going within a few yards of it and another two going within a couple miles of it, and all of that area is in a seismic fault called the Ramapo. It's just insane that anybody's even contemplating one of those things. Oh, and I forgot to mention the bomb trains that go up and down the Hudson on the rail lines that traverse from Albany. You know, there it's just like a series of terrible things waiting to happen.
The bomb trains?
Yes, the trains that, you know, car after car that are filled with bitumen from the tar sands of Canada and crude oil that are completely explosive. And they go through, they sit for sometimes for days right next to, if you go to Albany, I was taken on a tour of the area where there's a child's playground and a school just yards away from this, where they park these highly explosive, deadly trains full of gas. And they go down, you know, through New York City, past my sister's house in Pennsylvania. And I don't know where they end up, actually, to tell you the truth. I think they end up in Virginia, but just being near them gives me heart palpitations. I can't even imagine what it's like for the mother of children living in one of the apartments in a poor, mostly African-American community, I might add, in Albany, where they're parked for, there seems to be their switching station, and they park there for quite a while.
Anti-fracking activist and journalist Maura Stevens. She's a founding member of the Coalition to Protect New York and Frackbusters New York. Listen to the entire interview at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.